Good morning. I'd like to welcome everyone to the Second Court of Appeals. Thank you for being here today. We have one case to be argued, and my understanding is that the parties, the attorneys are here and they're ready to begin. Before we proceed, I'll ask the, first of all, let me introduce the panel to you. To my right is Justice Wade Birdwell. To my left is Justice Dabney Basil, and I'm Bonnie Sitter, the Chief of the Court. Now I'll ask the clerk. Clerk, to please call the case. You may proceed.
May it please the court. I'm Karen Purcell, and I'm here today with Peter Wells on behalf of the Famous Water Appellants. This dispute arises from agreements for the sale and purchase of a mineral water production and distribution business and bottling and related facilities that fell apart when a cash payment wasn't made, when financing issues arose, and when a historic preservation agreement could not be agreed upon. But as you know, the dispute today is not necessarily about the underlying transaction, but about whether the trial court erred in denying the Famous Water Party's motion to compel, which was based on two identical arbitration agreements that were in the interest purchase agreements. When Famous Water filed their motion to compel, the only response from Keio was a waiver dispense, not on the enforceability of the agreements. But at the hearing, the trial court questioned not waiver, but whether or not the word may in the arbitration provision resulted in a permissive venue rather than mandatory.
What are we to make of the fact that when y'all were up here for mandamus relief, it was y'all who were making the argument that the agreements were unenforceable agreements to agree?
Well, the letter of
So in other words, technically they're making, let's say they're making this argument about unenforceability for the first time on appeal. Do we have to ignore what y'all's position was when you were first up here asking for relief from the court?
Well, the letter of intent was superseded by the memorandum of understanding, and the memorandum of understanding was not a standalone enforceable agreement. You had to go to the terms of the interest purchase agreements, and the interest purchase agreements are where the arbitration provision appears.
Right, but when you were up here, you were taking the position that all 10 agreements were integrated, that in fact they were unenforceable because the historical agreement and the security agreement had not been executed, and therefore they were not enforceable as with regard to Famous Water, and that as a result, the venue provisions were not enforceable. So if the venue provisions are not enforceable under that circumstance, why were the arbitration provisions enforceable now?
Well, the interest purchase agreements and the land sale agreement were executed, but they weren't closed. And that was the part of the argument in the venue argument, was that they had not, the transaction itself had not closed, and that's why it wasn't a major transaction. And the reason it's enforceable is if you look at Section 8.3 in the interest purchase agreements, it's not tied to post-closing. It applies to pre-closing and post-closing disputes. So the fact that the LOI got superseded and the MOU is not a standalone agreement and the transaction didn't close doesn't mean that this dispute resolution mechanism doesn't apply when a dispute does arise between the parties.
Okay.
So the trial court was concerned about permissiveness, and so when Akio did their post-hearing briefing, they switched and talked about enforceability of the interest purchase agreements, which is where the arbitration provision lies. So the main issues here are permissiveness, enforceability, and waiver, but the agreement here is mandatory, enforceable, and not waived, and so there was no discretion to deny the motion to compel. Now, although
you agree with me from looking from 50,000 feet, the record in this case is kind of a mess.
Well, it's a mess in part because it was started in two different forums.
And we're applying abuse of discretion standard to the trial court decision to deny the motion to compel.
Well, it's a legal question if the agreement is enforceable and it falls within the scope.
But there are certain factual components here also with respect to length of time your clients waited to invoke their arbitration rights, the prior positions they took, and then to a certain extent, I guess it is a legal question, but the state of the documents. So I'm just concerned that second-guessing the trial court in this case might kind of violate the abuse of discretion standard.
Well, remember the passage of time, it came about because there was a Palo Pinto suit filed by Akio, and then they filed the Tarrant County suit, and then they also did a list pendants, which when Famous Water found out about, they did an expungement. And so there was all this work to try to get this cases consolidated, and when they couldn't, in January of 22, there was a motion to transfer venue, and that wasn't complete until December of 22. So the whole year, basically, of 2022 was the venue in the trial court and this court and the Supreme Court. So that takes a year of that out. And then the cases didn't all get finally consolidated until February 23rd of 22. So we're only talking about from February to June. That's the time frame of when we waited to move for arbitration, because you couldn't move for arbitration in three different suits, and because it's an integrated transaction. So if you only got one to arbitration, that really didn't do you any good. You needed all three in one place, and that didn't happen until February 23rd.
Well, I think Judge Birdwell's question, that probably the underlying basis was your clients perhaps have taken inconsistent positions that they originally indicated they did want to litigate.
No, they didn't indicate that they did not want arbitration. There was a September exchange about trying to get the suits consolidated, and there was some discussion there. But the only other place that they point to is in the venue provisions, I mean the venue briefing and hearing, and the two statements they rely on, one, that it was absurd. But what they said was absurd was that Akio could go and file these suits and ignore the venue or the arbitration provision, and then try to argue that they could rely on the Fort Worth provision in the venue provisions. So that's what was argued was absurd.
Counsel, you would agree with me that when you sought mandamus relief, that in both the petition and the reply, there was no mention of arbitration whatsoever. You would agree with that, correct?
Well, at that time, it was premature because the suits weren't consolidated.
Why should we consider it to be premature? Because the relief you were requesting was to be sent back to Palo Pinto. You wanted us to order the trial court in Tarrant County to abate that suit so that you could go litigate to a judgment, which is what the actual request for relief in the petition said, in Palo Pinto. And not only that, you argued to us that Judge Moore was the perfect trial judge to actually consider all of this litigation because they're, quote, he had already ruled on Akio's request for temporary restraining order. He presided over a full day of testimony during the party's temporary injunction hearing and conducted an extensive hearing on the form and substance of a protective order to govern discovery of confidential information exchange regarding all 10 integrated agreements. So that's what I'm concerned about, is whether or not Famous Water is taking inconsistent positions. Now, I know you've cited case law that says attempting to change venue does not actually constitute an implied waiver, but I don't see in those authorities, and you may correct me, but I don't see in those authorities a situation where the party actually made it all the way up to the Court of Appeals and took an inconsistent position. Because you were trying to get us to send everything back for litigation in Palo Pinto, not for purposes of sending it back to Palo Pinto so that you could file a motion to compel arbitration. That was never mentioned.
Well, the issue on venue is where's the venue proper, not if there's any request for arbitration that may have come up once they're all together. The venue argument is about what venue provision applies and where you should be. And Akio filed in Palo Pinto County first and filed a list pendants, so we filed in Palo Pinto County.
But you would agree that dominant jurisdiction is not venue necessarily. It's a distinct doctrine, and y'all were arguing dominant jurisdiction, not just merely venue, as to where would be the correct court to file your motion to compel arbitration. You were arguing that court had dominant jurisdiction and should be the one to adjudicate the disputes.
Well, that's true. If the arbitration provision wasn't enforceable and the claims are within the scope and we didn't request it, but you have to get to the court where they're all together before you get to that point to make the decision on arbitration.
Which gets me back to my original question, which you really didn't answer, which is, why should we consider your position, which was this agreement is an unenforceable agreement to agree, which is what your argument on the merits to us was, why that would mean you can later come back and say, oh, wait a minute, this is an agreement that can be enforced with regard to arbitration.
Well, again, the way I read the venue motion was that the letter of intent was superseded and unenforceable by the MOU. The MOU by itself, standing alone, doesn't have the terms of the agreement. And then the other ones had not closed. And that's why at that point it wasn't a major transaction.
But you're back to venue. I'm talking about your pleading in this court, your arguments in this court was dominant jurisdiction. It had nothing to do with a motion to transfer venue one way or the other. You were asking for abatement on the basis of dominant jurisdiction, and in reaching and asking us to rule in your favor, you were arguing that these agreements were unenforceable and that as a matter of dominant jurisdiction you should go back to litigate in Palo Pinto, not because it was the appropriate venue, but because the litigation had already started and it needed to finish there because Judge Moore was the person who was best in the position to do that.
Well, once it was in Palo Pinto County and he had heard the temporary injunction and all day evidence, if it were litigated, that would be the proper dominant jurisdiction and venue.
I have a question. Once it was consolidated, how long did your client wait to compel arbitration? Once it was consolidated?
It was consolidated on February 23rd. There was a pretrial scheduling conference on June 2nd, which Famous Water indicated their intent. So February 23rd to June 2nd, and then the venue motion, the petition was amended on June 29th, and the motion to compel was filed on June 30th. So June 2nd or June 30th, whichever of those, but that's either a 99-day or 127-day delay between complete consolidation and the venue motion.
Thank you.
I mean, the motion to compel. So the permissiveness, I'll touch that really quick, but basically in Exhibit C, if you look at 8.3, the word may appears in the middle of the paragraph, but also on the first sentence it says you do arbitration and then you do mediation and then arbitration, and then either party may request arbitration. And then the next paragraph says this agreement is specifically enforceable and it's final and binding. So what that means is either party can request it, but they're not required to. But once they request it, it's not optional. The other party doesn't get to object or reject the arbitration. And I think if you look at the case that's at Appendix K, it's a Supreme Court case, U.S. Home Corporation. They make that very clear when they say, while the warranty clause allowed either party to request arbitration, nothing suggests arbitration was optional if either did. And then we get to their arguments that they make post-hearing and on appeal, and they're talking about conflicts. And I'll just kind of touch it quickly, but the two cases they rely on, basically where the conflict comes from, is there were two agreements in one case and there were two provisions in the other case, but the arbitration provision said all, but the other provision said some other forum or said litigation, so there was a conflict between because all had to go to arbitration, and that's not what we have here. As I just said, one party can seek arbitration, but neither party has to. So there can be times when there would be litigation, and that's why you'd have a venue provision and a jury waiver provision. And they also argue about severability. That's just a standard severability clause. They also argue.
Well, they also argued up here on mandamus that, in fact, everything was integrated. So to the extent I'm hoisting you on that petard, I'll make myself a, I'll do that with regard to them when they get back up here. So.
And that's right. So if the interest purchase agreement has the arbitration provision. There's no conflict within it or with any other agreement, so that means it's enforceable. And then they argue express waiver based on the email that I have in your exhibits, and I think if you just read that, you'll see it's not, doesn't rise to the level and express unequivocal waiver of arbitration. And then finally, they go through the Perry Home factors, and I don't have time to go through all those, but I'll just say at this stage we're at, there's hardly any discovery that's gone on. If you read the trial court's comments, she says that they're barely out of the barn gates, and their lack of substantive work has been frustrating because of all the venue and procedural proceedings that have gone on. So she's acknowledging there's not much discovery that's gone on. We've already talked about the delay is only the four-month period. And there really hasn't been any rulings on the merits. All this has been procedural, Rule 11s, venue, consolidation, abatement, not merits-based. And then the expenses are...
Well, let me ask you about the merits-based, because this goes back to mandamus again, which is, y'all were arguing the merits in the petition for writ of mandamus, because that's where I get the language about an unenforceable agreement to agree, okay? You're arguing that, in fact, everything you're entitled to in part is because you need to go back because the agreement doesn't apply with regard to venue or anything else. It's just a matter of figuring out how to get rid of that Liz pendants and getting a declaration.
It wasn't a request for affirmative relief on the documents.
It was an argument to this court seeking affirmative relief.
Well, I'm not sure how you would argue the major transaction provision if you weren't arguing about the substance of the agreements to some extent.
Which was arguing the merits.
I disagree. So my time is up, so I'll...
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Fillmore?
May it please the court. I hope to cover the following three topics in my time today before the court.
You may not get there because we have a lot of questions. And I'm going to start off.
Okay, go ahead. Sorry.
Because I want to get a word in.
What do you want to get my three?
Can you walk me through what you contend in your brief was appellant's, and I'll quote, long history of arbitration waiving conduct? I kind of want to point by point, not too much detail, but just point me to the places where you think it was waiving conduct.
Okay, first, they should have closed to make the IPA enforceable against Acquio. The paragraph E is a condition precedent of any obligation for Acquio to have is contingent upon them complying, closing, transferring ownership of the companies. Otherwise, the IPA is not enforceable by them against Acquio. So that's number one. Number two, both parties, well, you wanted me to focus on appellants.
Their conduct.
Appellants.
Their long history of arbitration waiving conduct.
Appellants rushed to file their own independent lawsuit, not in response to anything that we had done. They filed their own independent lawsuit and have told the court we didn't even know we had been sued by Acquio. So they sued us.
Has there ever been an arbitration that's actually been able to remove a Liz pendants? Do you not have to have judicial adjudication to remove a Liz pendants?
I think their lawsuit went beyond Liz pendants. I
understand
that's part of it.
But that would have been the anchor for them doing that, would it not? And I'm not aware of an arbitration situation where the arbitrator gets to make a determination of whether a Liz pendants is removed.
I'm not aware of one either, but frankly, I hadn't thought of that issue, but I'm not aware of that either.
It's some things come to me sometimes.
They filed their own lawsuit. Then three, when we are talking to them about whether to waive arbitration, they do agree to waive arbitration.
With the would language,
With would. But okay. in the colloquial, you know, Texas talk, people say, I would agree with that, and that signifies agreement. And if that email was standing alone and they had immediately filed an answer or some other pleading saying, we are reserving our right to arbitrate, then I think the would might be more ambiguous, but in the context of their activity following that email, I believe that the email becomes very much a waiver of arbitration and documents an agreement between the parties as such. Their explanation that, well, it was contingent upon us agreeing to consolidation doesn't hold water because we didn't agree to consolidation and that was known immediately. And so you don't see any sort of activity by the appellants like, oh, well, since you didn't agree to our terms on consolidation, now we're moving for arbitration. No, they filed a motion to transfer venue and motion to abate, and in the briefing to Judge McCoy, they described the IPA's arbitration provision as irrelevant. Twice it's irrelevant. And with due respect to my opposing counsel, she did not give an appropriate, I don't believe, explanation of the absurd language in their briefing. What the appellants did was they pointed out to Judge McCoy that we have repudiated arbitration. They didn't say the word repudiate, but we have repudiated arbitration by filing a lawsuit, and it would be absurd for anyone to suggest that they are bound by arbitration. And so I take that as another repudiation, again, another confirmation of a crossroads crossed by them where they picked litigation over arbitration. Then on March 3, the irrelevant and absurd, that's January 10, 2022. On March 3, 2022, again, they state in a hearing, Acquio has filed two lawsuits. Neither one of them is an arbitration action. We have not demanded arbitration. That clause should not apply. So they make the statement, we're not demanding arbitration. I know they didn't say are not, but we have not demanded arbitration. That clause should not apply. That is another explicit, express waiver of arbitration. And then in their briefing to the Supreme Court of Texas, they, to Justice Birdwell's points a little while ago, they tell that court that they are relators, fully intend to proceed in Palo Pinto County. Here's another quote. Nor is there any indication that relators have lost interest in prosecuting their claims in Palo Pinto County. The Palo Pinto County litigation is proceeding apace. Relators have claims there for affirmative relief.
Counsel, in what manner are we able to take notice of briefing in the Supreme Court?
The trial
court. I went looking for that I understand we can take judicial notice of our stuff, but
it is my understanding.
I didn't see any argument or authority from y'all with regard to, hey, that's effectively a judicial estoppel by their argument there.
The trial court took judicial notice of the Supreme Court briefing in the order. So that has been done. And I believe the case law says that any information on a governmental website that is public access, a court can take judicial notice of. I've seen cases that say that. It is obviously the Supreme Court's governmental website. It's publicly available. You should find it and click on it, and it is there. But I think most importantly, the trial court took judicial notice of that, and that is not an issue. No one has objected to the trial court taking judicial notice of that. And so one last quote, there can be no doubt that relators still desire to prosecute their claims in Palo Pinto County. Both their claims and multiple motions remain pending there. Last quote from their Supreme Court briefing. As you pointed out, well, I'll keep going on the list. So they lose at the Supreme Court. They come back and they want their claims consolidated into, rather than just dismiss their lawsuit and file an answer in our case in Tarrant County, they want their claims consolidated into the Tarrant County case, and that is accomplished. There is discovery that is entered into. They have told the trial court, we have conducted significant discovery, a lot of discovery, and that's why the court can rush this case to trial in October of 2023. So they moved for an expedited trial setting and told the court, and part of the reason that they moved is, this case is basically ready. We can be ready by then. We've done a lot of discovery. It's been pending too long. Let's do this, and let's try the case in October of 2023. So those are some of the things. They waited until they filed a first amended answer, no mention of arbitration. They waited until June 29 to file an answer that mentioned arbitration, and that was after they lost their motion to essentially back out of the agreed order realigning the parties in the case. The significance of that is they were not content to be counter plaintiffs. They wanted to be plaintiffs to preserve a claim for attorney's fees. And so after they agreed to the motion to consolidate and realign the parties, they signed the agreed order doing so, where they were counter plaintiffs. At some point they decided, wait a minute, that might destabilize our attorney's fees claim. We want to be plaintiffs. And so they filed a motion to basically get out of that agreement that they had made and out of that agreed order that had been entered by the court. And so it was only after Judge McCoy denied that motion and the discovery from we start seeking discovery from them, they don't want to give it up. Now, they did produce 4,400 pages of information that they identified in their initial disclosure responses, but we have sent them requests for production, we have sent them interrogatories, and we have met with resistance after resistance after resistance.
Resistance is not affirmative, asking for affirmative relief. That's just resistance.
I agree, but it goes to, I think, the issue of one of the Perry Home factors is, have they been losing and they're just switching places to avoid further losses? And I think that have they used the discovery process to their advantage and to our disadvantage, and now when the noose is getting tight, they want to hit the ejector seat and go into arbitration to avoid that? I think it's relevant to that. So in any event, I think there has been significant arbitration waiving and consistent arbitration waiving conduct in this case. And I would also like to say one other thing on that. They claim, and I really don't know how big a deal this is, but they claim that we mentioned arbitration at the June 2 initial scheduling conference. That's when we first raised arbitration. It's in their brief. It was repeated just then. If the court looks up their sites for that, the sites are simply them claiming to have done it. There is no record of them doing that. And their certificate of conference on their motion to compel arbitration says documents that they contacted us on this motion on June 21. And that is, I believe, much, much closer to what actually happened. I think that is what actually happened. There is no record of them mentioning arbitration at the June 2 hearing. So we went through that hearing. We got a scheduling order. That's another thing they lost. And then at some point after our third motion to compel was filed, and they get their motion to realign denied, to re-realign denied, at that point they're like, let's just get out of here. And so that's when they filed their motion to compel arbitration. Their claim that they have been waiting since the fall of 2021 for there to be one lawsuit in which to file a motion to compel arbitration is, in my view, not believable. There is nothing that would have prevented them from filing in any of those actions. And we gave them the opportunity to do that in the spring of 2022 when we dismissed or non-suited our Palo Pinto case, brought it in the Fort Worth case, in the Tarrant County case. Their Everything was there, but they continued to fight to have their case decided in Palo Pinto. And it is a merits-based, as Justice Birdwell is right. It was merits-based for two reasons. First, that the agreements were unenforceable agreements to agree.
Which is now your position.
No.
Is your position because you've said, arbitration is not enforceable because the agreement's not enforceable because these other predicate things did not occur, which is exactly what their position was back then.
We never took a position on the enforceability of the arbitration in the mandamuses. I believe the IPA is enforceable against Acquio once they have closed and there's been a successful closing and all of the transfer, the ownership interests have been transferred.
That's essentially
to us.
Their argument in the petition for writ of mandamus, that because the heritage agreement and the security agreements were conditions precedent to the entirety of the integrated agreement occurring, that there was nothing enforceable even about the IPAs.
But we have, our position has been, from Acquio's perspective, it has been enforceable from the beginning and is enforceable by Acquio against them.
Good. Let me ask you a question about your statement about the fact that they're not bringing up arbitration at any point in time in Palo Pinto, as far as I can see. Okay, you go to a full-blown temporary injunction hearing and there's no discussion of arbitration at that point in time. Okay, was there anything preventing them from bringing up arbitration under those circumstances? In other words, I understand they're making the argument now that they needed to clean up the venue, they needed to clean up the dominant jurisdiction, they needed to make sure they were in one court where they could compel arbitration. Is there any case law that actually supports the position that they at no time could have actually brought up and moved to compel arbitration in Palo Pinto County at the very beginning of the temporary injunction?
I am aware of no case law that would prohibit the appellants from moving for arbitration in every single one of the cases that are pending. If you want to arbitrate, you at least file a motion saying, we're reserving our right to arbitrate. We want to arbitrate. That's what we want to do. And I'm aware of no cases that say that an arbitration motion filed in a court of improper venue is a nullity, or a court with improper venue cannot order someone into arbitration.
But maybe they didn't want piecemeal arbitration. Maybe they wanted to consolidate first and make sure that they were taking the whole package to arbitration, because that would save cost of litigation, it seems to me.
They had that opportunity in the Tarrant County litigation in the spring on April 1 of 2022, when we non-suited our Palo Pinto case and brought our Palo Pinto claims in the Tarrant County case on April 1, 2022. April 1, 2022 was a Friday, but on the next Monday they could have answered, dropped their mandamus, which was currently pending in this court, answered, put everything in Tarrant County, and filed their motion there and then. And especially since...
Did they even have to put it in Tarrant County? Why could they not have moved to compel arbitration from Judge Moore in Palo Pinto?
They absolutely could
have. Was there a party that couldn't be compelled or something of that nature?
They could have filed their motion in Palo Pinto. They could have filed it here. Either one. And they didn't.
So you're saying they should have abandoned their Palo Pinto suit in favor of Tarrant County and then move for arbitration in Tarrant County?
Yes, if your goal is arbitration, and the arbitration resides in Tarrant County.
So they've got to give up a right that they thought they had to be in Palo Pinto to get the arbitration from Tarrant County. Is that what you're saying?
Would you say that again, please? Sorry.
So they had to give up their right, as they saw it, to be in Palo Pinto County and move to Tarrant County, then compel arbitration.
Yes, they would. If they've got a clear path to arbitration, then they don't want to litigate in Palo Pinto because the arbitration is in Fort Worth, not in Palo Pinto.
But now sometimes you lose on your motion to compel arbitration.
Okay.
So should they have to give up their Palo Pinto lawsuit that they thought they had the right or wrong, to have in order to invoke arbitration in Tarrant County?
I don't think they would have to give it up. I think they could keep that there and then just come into Tarrant County and leave it as a placeholder, come into Tarrant County.
I'm sorry, I thought that's what your argument was, that they should have, at that point in April 1st of 2022, abandoned their Palo Pinto case and just sought arbitration out of Tarrant County.
They could have done that. They could have done either one, I believe. I think they could have done either
one. Had they done it in Palo Pinto, then they'd be in front of the Eastland Court of Appeals.
Correct. We like it.
Just wanted to make a note of that.
That's right. That's right. I would like to point one thing out. My time is very short. With regard to their argument that paragraph E is a mere recital, their reply brief is suffused with, they call it, I think, 36 times recital E, recital paragraph E. That does not work at all because of paragraph 8.12 of the contract of the IPA, which states the headings in this agreement are inserted for convenience only and shall not constitute a part hereof. So their claim and their theory that a paragraph E can be either ignored or devalued because it's a mere recital depends upon the court's violation of 8.12. It's not a part of the contract, the word recital.
Did you
recital.
Raise paragraph E in the trial court?
Not explicitly. Implicitly, by arguing the theory that there were conditions precedent that had not been complied with that prevent the arbitration provision from being enforced. We argued that the arbitration provision was not enforceable because of provisions within the contract. The contract was in front, the full contract was in front of Judge McCoy. And on real quick on the issue of whether we somehow defaulted or relieved them of their burden of proof to prove a valid and enforceable contract, arbitration contract, Judge McCoy, during the hearing, questioned them on this point, and they said they did not claim that we had waived an enforceability challenge as by challenging their conduct as waiver. And that's on page 21 of the transcript, volume 4 of the reporter's record.
Let me ask you one other quick question, please, sir. This May argument that makes 8.3 permissive, I don't see a lot in your brief about that. Are you all abandoning that argument?
No, we are not abandoning that argument. It is in the summary of the argument where we point that out, and it is also embedded in our portions of the brief where we point out that it takes a joint submission of the parties to arbitration for arbitration to occur. Both parties, you know, the language requires joint submission. And so it is in that because that would be a may, because the parties may not want to jointly submit. There, we believe that that is another condition that has to be met. The parties have to jointly submit it to arbitration.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, I'll start with the recital because most of the questions went to waiver, but the recital, if you look at the language right after the recitals, it says, now therefore the parties intending to be legally bound agree as follows, not what's before, but what follows. And recital E is consistent with section 7.2, and it has to do with obligations of the buyer being conditioned on the seller transferring assets and interests. So it's just apples and oranges to what they want it to be. And they didn't make the argument in the trial court. In the trial court, they were arguing about pre-closing conditions precedent, which I think they've waived anyway when they filed this suit. You don't get to go back and then invoke those provisions. Now what they're arguing is that somehow recital E created some post-closing requirement that you can't use until post-closing. Nothing in 8.3 requires or triggers to Polk's closing. The Liz Pendens lawsuit, to go to that, it was defensive in nature. And by the way, filing suit, even the Texas Supreme Court said that that alone does not waive arbitration. That's the Richmond case. I disagree again on the absurd. It was really was saying that it was absurd to bind Famous Water to Fort Worth based on that arbitration provision. I disagree on irrelevant, but I'll leave that to the briefing. I did want to go through the consolidation, the motion to amend the consolidation order, because I think it's not really clear from what Mr. Fillmore said. But what happened was there was a joint motion to amend the order or to consolidate, and that's all it was. There was no request to change the styles of the case. That's all that was granted in the order was the motion to consolidate, It was only agreed as to form. And then when we got to the hearing on the motion to amend, it was clear that the trial court did not believe that she had changed the style of the case. She said it was still the same as it was, and that she would allow people to come back. She didn't want to do it then. She didn't want to change it then. But she would allow people to come back and change it from what she had it on her jacket. And if you look at the order that was entered on June 22nd, she actually kept the style as she had it with counter plaintiffs and counter defendants and plaintiffs and defendants. So she did not change the style of the case when and didn't intend to. And when she did the order, she also has a place here where she says any legal ramifications of the agreed order to transfer or consolidate may be discussed at a later hearing if requested. So she was not just denying this and ruling it anyway on the merits. And then also he says there's been a lot of discovery, but all there was pre-mediation. There was one depot because Famous Water had the right to enter or depose someone from Akio because they had already had testimony from Mr. Elder at the temporary injunction hearing. So to balance it out, before the mediation there was a depot and one depot on written questions. Post-mediation, there was one interrogatory and three deposition on written questions. That's it as far as what Famous Water has done.
I think we did get virtually every email between the parties in the mandamus record. I just vaguely remember that. But I do have a question. Both parties have taken the position that the agreements are not enforceable, okay? Depending upon which proceeding that you're in. Is it Famous Water's position that the arbitration provision is a standalone arbitration agreement that applies to everything, even if ultimately the arbitrator makes the determination that there was never an actual meeting of the minds with regard to the parties? And does Moncrief, our recent Moncrief decision, does that have anything to do with our determination in that regard?
I don't believe the Moncrief. I'll double check Moncrief and not if I am wrong, but I don't think that it had bearing on the issues that we have here.
Okay.
In terms of 8.3, it is not tied to closing. And like I said before, the argument on the venue and dominant jurisdiction, all that, was that they hadn't closed and therefore they weren't enforceable because there was no closing. But the dispute mechanism applies pre or post closing, and that makes sense because if it falls apart, then there has to be something that decides where the dispute's going to be resolved. And their post closing through Recital E just doesn't work, and it's in the reply brief, so I won't go back through that. And the last thing I want to say is there's absolutely no merits ruling here. If you look at the cases, they're looking for motions for summary judgment. You failed on your class action appeal. You've had multiple summary judgments. You got to some position in the case where you were going to lose on the merits, and that's what they're looking for in terms of prejudice, and that's just not here. And there's no merits rulings. And I see my time's up.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Counselors, we appreciate your argument. It's been helpful to us this morning. Your case has now been submitted, and you are now free to go about your business. Thank you.
Sorry. You collect everything.
The Honorable Court of Appeals of the Second District of Texas now stands adjourned.